If you live on or near the West Coast, you know you're in earthquake country. But what might surprise you is that most of the United States is frighteningly vulnerable to earthquakes that could do major damage to infrastructure as well as costing many lives. Find out all about it with Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. It's all new and all blue next. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Our guest this week is author Catherine Miles. Her last book, Superstorm, took an in-depth look at Hurricane Sandy. In her new book, Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake, Miles examines the threat to lives and infrastructure posed by seismic activity. And it's not just in the usual places associated with earthquakes, but virtually encompasses the entire country. She joined us via Skype from her home in Maine. Catherine Miles, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in writing this book? Because I know previously you had a book about Hurricane Sandy, the superstorm. What got you interested in earthquakes?
And, you know, it really is sort of a logical corollary to the book Superstorm. The full title is Superstorm 9 Days Inside of Hurricane Sandy. And in that research, I spent a lot of time looking at prediction, forecasting, and also infrastructure, both the literal infrastructure like our bridges and roads and levees and airports, but also what I like to call our metaphoric infrastructure, things like our forecasting and prediction, our ability to sort of track science, climate, things like that. And as we were sort of wrapping up that tour, you know, my editor and I were talking and we, you know, kind of looked at each other and said, you know, this is how our nation will fare and frankly not fare in the face of a disaster like a hurricane. What would happen in the case of an earthquake? And we realized that, you know, no one has really done sort of a popular science approach to that. And obviously the time was very ripe for that to happen now.
Well, when you read about earthquakes in history, you generally get kind of the typical list, which is Lisbon, 755, New Madrid, 1811, 12, San Francisco, 1906, Chile, 1960, and Alaska, 1964, that kind of list. You start your book, though, with an earthquake that most people have probably never heard of. Tell us a little bit about Hebgen Lake.
Right. In so many ways, I really saw this earthquake as, I mean, first of all, it's something straight out of a Hollywood movie, but it also seems really emblematic to me of the sort of snowball effect that happens, both in terms of an actual sort of seismic event and then the sort of subsequent ability or inability to cope with it. And this was an earthquake that happened right outside of Yellowstone on sort of a perfect summer night. It was not all that large of an earthquake by national and international standards, but it was certainly one capable of doing a great deal of damage, including what is arguably the largest landslide in American history. And I detail one family in particular who sort of, you know, by a series of completely sort of, you know, inadvertently bad luck decisions were right in the heart of the earthquake. And so not only was the quake itself hugely significant and devastating, but then I sort of track how difficult our ability to respond to an earthquake is, both in terms of first responders, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of things like hospitals. And in so many ways, this seemed like a really sort of gripping example of just how large that sort of disaster stream can be, and just how hard it can be to meet it effectively.
And the family that you talked about, that was such a tragic story. I'm trying to remember the name of the mother.
Yes, you know, this was an example of, again, sort of wrong place, wrong time. She unfortunately died of her injuries. The father lived. The three daughters survived and still live today, actually on the Wasatch Fault, which is outside of Salt Lake City, right, again, in the heart of earthquake territory. And, you know, they talk a lot about how the sort of effects, kind of a PTSD type situation, remain very true for them over 50 years later.
And, you know, I think one of the things for me, you know, reading the book is at times it especially that part, it's very frightening. And if you've never experienced a large earthquake, you have no idea how frightening it is, because it just comes suddenly out of nowhere. The literally the ground that you think of as solid becomes something totally else, and it's a cacophony of noises and motions that the human nervous system just doesn't cope with well.
Right. And I talk about this in Quakeland. There's an emerging field of psychology that's really looking at disaster psychology and the effects that disaster has on us, both as individuals and collectively. We see obviously sort of heightened examples of and instances of depression, of violence, other sorts of kind of auxiliary conditions, if you will. And what these psychologists tell us is that earthquakes are sort of uniquely affecting in their ability to really kind of, you know, sort of psychologically rattle us, emotionally rattle us, if you will. And there's a couple of theories about why. One of them is if you think about things like hurricanes, tornadoes, even the devastating fires that we're seeing around Sonoma, what we see is there's a little bit of warning there. You know, with a hurricane, you may have a couple of days. With a tornado, you may have 10, 15 minutes. But an earthquake literally in the United States right now exists without warning. And not only that, but if you think about the sort of metaphoric significance of the ground beneath our feet and the way in which we use metaphors like bedrock and foundation and this idea of sort of terra firma, when that is disrupted, it has a uniquely powerful effect on us. Not to mention the physical effect on us. If you've ever been on a boat on an ocean, for instance, and step back off onto the dock and you feel like the dock is rocking like the ocean was, that happens to our inner ears as well, too. So there's a physiological effect, too.
Yes. You know, one of the things that struck me, because my formal training is in the geosciences, is how poor our understanding really is of what's going on inside the Earth just a few miles below our feet. And that I found that part of your book especially interesting.
And that was shocking to me. You know, when I was writing Superstorm, I spent some time down at the National Hurricane Center meeting with the hurricane specialists down there. And these are obviously sort of, you know, the best in the business. And they kept saying to me, you know, look, we're still not very good at predicting hurricanes. And we're still not very sophisticated at all of that. And that was amplified to an exponential degree when I was meeting with seismologists and geophysicists and geologists for this book. And as I sort of joke in the book, you know, there's sort of a almost sort of Mad Libs kind of situation where you can fill in the blank, where over and over again, they would say, we know more about blank than we do the actual Earth, you know, and it's really a very recent phenomenon, thanks to sort of improving technology and our ability to use, you know, plane-based technology, things like GIS, to really get an understanding of what happens inside the planet. But we still, as I say in the book, know more about outer universes than we do about our own planet.
You went to some really interesting places when you researched this book. Especially standing out to me was the Lucky Friday mine and Hoover Dam. So let's start with the mine, because there is no way you could get me to do what you did.
This is my very favorite part of my job. I think a lot about James Thurber and his short story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And one of the best parts about being a participatory journalist is getting to sort of live the lives of fascinating people for a day. And in this case, this was one of the deepest silver mines in the United States, about 7,000 feet down. And I spent a day down inside the mine with the staff geologist, whose job it is to sort of, you know, assess the geological soundness of the mine, both in terms of sort of tracking these mineral veins, but also in terms of trying to keep the miner safe. And what we know is that mining has a long history of creating seismic activity, what miners have historically called rock bursts. And as these mines get deeper and bigger, and as our ability to work in them becomes more sophisticated, the seismic activity that we create, what seismologists call induced seismicity or human-induced seismicity, increases. And so whereas it used to be the case that one of these instances would, you know, tragically affect the lives and in some cases end the lives of miners below the surface, now we're seeing that this induced seismicity has the ability to do real damage above ground too.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, on the road to America's next devastating earthquake. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake.
Oh, let's talk about the Hoover Dam part, because I found that just absolutely fascinating. You kept trying to find out, you know, could this dam actually fail in an earthquake? And tell us about the response you got.
And this was a lot of fun for me, because we do have these Hollywood depictions of earthquakes that go back to the 1920s. Most recently, we had the film San Andreas with The Rock and Paul Giamatti. And you know, Hollywood does a really great job of sort of creating the most sensational account of what an earthquake would look like possible. And for some reason, we go back to the Hoover Dam again and again and again. And so I thought, well, this will be a really fun opportunity to look at this sort of iconic landmark in sort of U.S. Structures and think through what would actually happen. And so I spent some time there with tour guides, with the resident safety monitors there. And the sort of short version of the story is it's probably one of the best places to be in the planet in the case of an earthquake, but that is definitely not true for a lot of other dams in the country.
When we talk about places where earthquakes tend to occur, I live in a plate boundary zone where I'm between subduction zone volcanic activity and Lassen Park and the Cascades, and right off the shore is the end of the San Andreas Fault. So in California, you know, we think of ourselves as living in earthquake country. But one of the big takeaways from your book is that almost everywhere in the United States is earthquake country.
And this is really what I wanted the take-home message of this book to be, because I think that especially for those of us who lived on the East Coast, it's really tempting to say, you know, seismic hazard and risk is really a West Coast problem, and frankly, a California problem. But what my research taught me, and what I hope this book sort of explores for the reading public, is the way in which it really is a national problem, not only because we have these sort of beds of seismic activity in places you wouldn't expect, like Memphis, like New York, like Washington, D.C., like Salt Lake City, but also because the effects of an earthquake, no matter where it is going to have really significant negative effects on economy, on trade, on commerce, on communication streams. And so not only do we not know where the next earthquake is going to happen, but we really don't know the full range of effects. And it's naive of us to think that because we live in a place that's not California, that those effects won't reach us in some very profound ways.
Well, and you've particularly focused on New York City and Washington. Tell us about the seismic risks to New York.
Yeah, and you know, this was a really big surprise for me. And we should say, when seismologists and when folks at, for instance, the U.S. Geological Survey talk about this, they talk about it in terms of risk and hazard. And it is certainly true that the likelihood of a major earthquake is less in New York City than it is in a place like Anchorage or, you know, the Salton Sea outside of San Diego. The overall effect of that earthquake would frankly be larger and more profound. And there are a variety of reasons for that. First of all, the East Coast geology is made largely of granite and bedrock, and that tends to not dissipate waves the same way as the softer soils of the West. So an identical, say, 6.5 quake in LA and New York would actually feel stronger, would do more damage in New York. The other thing is looking at things like infrastructure and preparedness. If we look at what geologists call the return rate, and that is a sort of historic instance of earthquakes happening over hundreds or thousands of years, we know that New York has had a moderate earthquake every 100 years, pretty close to on the dot 100 years. The last moderate earthquake in New York was 1883. And so while this is not a precise science and we certainly can't predict earthquakes, it's fair to say that New York is overdue now for a moderate quake. And this moderate quake, which is say a 5.5, for instance, not all that huge, really, frankly, by West Coast standards, would be enough to do incredible damage to the city. And the Office of Emergency Management there says that, you know, a quake of that size would create more rubble, more destruction, be costlier, frankly, than September 11th.
Well, if we look at places where there is a high degree of seismic risk, like, for example, the Pacific Northwest with the Cascadia subduction zone, and Southern California, which has got the San Andreas Fault, as they say, locked and loaded. The one that really kind of stood out reading the book to me, which I was aware of before, but, you know, thinking about the infrastructure and what it would do to our economy, is New Madrid and all of the infrastructure in that area. Could you tell us a little bit about your visit, like, to FedEx?
Sure. This was a great time for sure. If you ever have the opportunity and you want an adrenaline rush, I can highly recommend it. So New Madrid, the fault zone, as you mentioned earlier, had a series of very significant earthquakes in 1811, 1812. We think approximately an 8.3. We can't say for sure, but certainly a significant and some of the largest in this country's history. At some point for another series of earthquakes, we think as strong as that. We don't know if that'll be in a year or 100 years or 500 years, but certainly the seismologists and emergency managers say that the risk is significant enough that we should behave as if it's going to happen next year. And while it can be sort of tempting to say, okay, so there'll be a big earthquake, it'll affect St. Louis and Memphis, you know, blues will suffer, you know, barbecue will suffer, but it's not really going to affect the rest of us. That's really short-sighted because, in some surprising ways, Memphis is the real commercial hub of the United States. And you mentioned FedEx. Their world headquarters are located there. UPS has their third largest hub there. And on any given night, about 400 planes land at the Memphis International Airport in this incredibly intricate, choreographed event. They come from all over the world. About 4 million packages are offloaded these planes. They're sorted, they're repackaged and put on new planes and sent out. And if that's not impressive enough, I think it's important to consider that in addition to your Amazon order, in addition to your prescription drugs and your car parts, your mortgage payments that are passing through there, the two largest contractors of FedEx are the U.S. Mail and the U.S. military. So we're not only looking at issues of commerce, we're also, frankly, looking at issues of national security. There's one bridge, the interstate bridge that crosses the Mississippi River there. Approximately 35% of all of our trucking commerce passes across that bridge on any given day. And then we have the added effect of the Mississippi River traffic, some incredibly fragile levees that could potentially flood most of our farmland. And so it's a recipe for catastrophic disaster. In fact, according to FEMA, it's one of the four worst disaster scenarios that could befall the country.
And I found the historic account of 1811 and 12 particularly interesting. I can remember hearing the stories about the Mississippi River reversing course, and I love the fact that you add in there parenthetically, not true.
Nor did it crack the Liberty Bell, though that makes a good story as well.
I love those apocryphal stories that are not true.
Yeah, but I think it really goes to the ways in which we tend to respond to natural disaster as a culture, frankly, and that is to really underestimate it sort of leading up to one. And then afterwards, because it's so much bigger than anything our imagination can bear, it's almost like we have to come up with these apocryphal stories to make sense of something that's senseless, frankly.
I loved your argument discussion with the tour guide on the tour boat out on the river when he was trying to tell you it was a 9 point something, and you were, no, it was an 8 point, and the argument that ensued where it was like, he was going to cling to that even though that might be tectonically impossible.
And this is, in a way, I think the book kind of serves as sort of a primer on sort of seismology 101, And for instance, one of the things I say early in the book is if you really want to not impress a seismologist, say Richter scale, for instance. That's something that we amateurs tend to do and they don't do. And so I wanted to kind of have a little bit of fun in the book as well, too, and kind of poke at some of the myths and the misperceptions that we all operate under, both in terms of pop culture and, frankly, in terms of science.
Yes, we use the moment magnitude scale. So that's one thing I never do is I never say the Richter. And when I hear somebody say the Richter scale, I just cringe.
Yeah, you're not alone in that for sure.
I've got a lot of friends at the USGS that they really appreciate it when I tweet things out to journalists saying, don't use the Richter scale. That's not what it is. It's just call it.
Make sure you know what epicenter means, because we misuse that one a lot too.
Yeah. Yeah, the point above the rupture on the surface. Let's talk about nukes, because, you know, one of the things that I found interesting and kind of scary, there's so many things that are kind of scary in your book, is nuclear energy in its many forms and how that intersects with earthquakes, like, for example, Fukushima in 2011 and a lot of the nuclear power plants along the West Coast that have been decommissioned or, you know, fights over them being put in because of earthquake faults. You talk about that a bit, too, about nuclear power plants and their vulnerability because of earthquake faults.
And it's sort of a sort of tragic irony that we've actually found quite a few faults in this United States by way of construction of nuclear power plants. Diablo in California is a great example of that. We've seen similar situations in Virginia, for instance, where it's the actual construction and siting of these power plants that allows us to find these faults. And as I say in the book, you know, we have about 2,100 recorded faults that we know of in the United States. And what the folks at the USGS say is that it's probably exponentially more actual faults. We just haven't found them yet. So, you know, we should say, you know, and I don't want to be sensational. We should say that in general, nuclear power plants tend to, like the Hoover Dam, tend to be very overbuilt. And so in that regard are quite secure, but do come with their own seismic hazard and risk as well. And you mentioned Fukushima. There was an incredibly powerful subduction earthquake, the kind that we might, for instance, potentially see in the Northwest. There's much debate right now about how much damage that actual earthquake did to the power plant because, you know, as your listeners probably know, it was quickly followed by a massive catastrophic tsunami. And the tsunami, in fact, was what did the most damage to the plant and led to the eventual meltdown. After Fukushima, the NRC took a really hard look at some of the U.S. power plants and started to kind of think about risk and where the biggest risk lies in terms of our power plants. Outside of California, they designated two as the highest risk, and they are Plymouth Pilgrim, outside of Plymouth, Massachusetts, and Indian Point, located just 20 miles north of New York City. Both plants are owned by a company called Entergy. The company plans to close these plants. And so they were given a pass by the NRC to do some of the mandatory Fukushima retrofit that was required of other nuclear power plants. And folks at organizations like the Union for Concerned Scientists have some real reservations and objections, frankly, to that. They look at what happened at Fukushima, where the egress of water ultimately prevented the plant from cooling. And they say, hey, look, this could happen. And this could happen not only because of an earthquake, this could happen because of a nor'easter. They look at the potential for earthquakes in places like New York City and they say, listen, say a magnitude 7.0 quake, something that people think is possible on the Ramapo Fault outside of New York City, this could actually do damage to the reactor. We could, you know, worst case scenario, see the evacuation of New York City as well, too. So I wanted to really understand that risk and understand why it is a risk and to see just to what degree we all ought to be concerned about it.
And I also enjoyed the part where you tried to visit Yucca Flat, the nuclear storage site there at the nuclear test range, and they weren't going to let you go unless you brought 25 friends or something like that. And
exactly, they only did group tours, and I was a group of one, so I was 24 short.
And you definitely couldn't bring booze.
No, or tape recorder.
I found that to be hilarious. The thing they should really worry about is a reporter that might bring a flask.
I wanted the book to be fun in that regard, and I wanted it to be sort of the classic American road trip and have that kind of Americana and that kitsch to it as well, too, and kind of think through a lot of, like I said earlier, pop culture and marry that with science. You know, science should be fun. And while I think there is a lot in the book that is kind of scary, I also wanted the book to be the kind of thing you would just want to read when you were on an airplane or maybe even at the beach and maybe learn some science along the way.
You certainly succeed in that intent, because I there were many times I laughed out loud reading the book.
Oh, well, that makes me very happy. Thank you.
What was something that really surprised you in your research for this? One thing that stands out?
It was really, really about induced seismicity and just the number of different ways that we set off earthquakes. I think a lot of people are familiar with what's happening in Oklahoma right now, a state that had very little seismic activity, say 10 years ago, and now is the most seismically active state in the lower 48. And when we look at, for instance, wastewater injection associated with fracking there, and we look at the increased seismic activity there, we see a pretty clear correlation between the wastewater injection and earthquakes. Scientists in Alberta feel like they have really established a similar correlation between fracking itself. But there are all sorts of other ways that are surprising. I mentioned the mines earlier, oil extraction, the injection of chemical weapons waste into the ground, even things like digging tunnels, building high-rises, filling reservoirs, all create seismic activity. And that was a real surprise for me, and I suspect it will be for readers as well.
Well, Catherine Miles, it was a pleasure talking to you, and best of luck to you in your future endeavors. And I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much, and I was very glad to join you on the show.
Thanks to our guest, Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews or me at Dave Schloem. Our engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, was written and performed by Matt Schiltz of New York City. For all of us here, I remind you there that we all live on a pale blue dot.